Welcome to Peter Hill Explains, where we have a conversation about things scientific. In this conversation, we're going to look at the 2015 final year exam, the Quantity Quark option. That's a quarter of the year is dedicated. Schools can go off in different predefined areas. And they're marked at the end with these five questions. Now, the discussion of things scientific is the science itself, but also an insight into what's taught, how it's taught, why, and things. So if you're a student, you can take the science away with you. If you're a teacher, you can see how I've taught it. And if you're an academic, you can scratch your heads and say, yes, we are teaching this. This is could be true, but there may be other things we should better teach. Now, the process that we've settled down on is read the question, have a general lecture about it, just off the top of my head. This is not an exclusive process on how it goes. And then do the formula sheet, which is a necessary thing. The formula sheet and the pre-lecture are the key to get going. Then read the question, answer the question, and then check how did I go after all that effort. So if you can hang in there, it's probably worth a listen. If not, I'll be producing heaps and heaps of these podcasts, improving all the time. So our two questions. So I break it up. There are five questions in these option sections, and I break it up into three podcasts. Unbelievably, three podcasts. Questions 1 and 2, or A and B, C and D. And E. E, I don't do the formula sheet again because that's a bit hard. But still go into it. So let's start with C. The question is, explain why the spectroscope was important in the development of the Bohr model of the atom. And the other thing I have to talk about, that's interesting because I am a spectroscopist and interesting. Okay, a D. In 1927, Davison and Germer reported the results of an experiment in which they fired electrons at a crystal of nickel and observed how the electrons were scattered. I suppose scattered? Yeah, diffracted, I'd say. Okay, part one of that is state their conclusion with reference to the results they obtained. Explain the significance of this experiment to the Rutherford-Bohr model of the atom. 3 marks. Okay, yes, right, we'll look into that. Okay, so this is the lecture section of it, then we'll get the formula sheet again. So, spectroscopy comes from, so this is not the school talk, this is just an expert talking about it. Okay, so spectroscopy comes from the medieval art of ghost hunting. Spectroscopy is I look for ghosts, and what they do is they look for auras of ghosts, colors from ghosts. So the ghosts, if there was a ghostly glow in belief of things like that, and particularly the green colour and various colours like that. Then prisms were observed, and Newton applied a prism for the first time and actually broke white light out into different colours. So before Newton, there was not much understanding. I have read Descartes, and he actually did quite a lot of it there. So Newton came up with the corpuscular idea of light, and said the light comes as a range of corpuscles, which goes into our photons, and they go to different points. And so we had the prism. Now, a spectroscope is something that you look at. I think a spectrometer is a more accurate. Okay, a spectroscope is something which is like a telescope. It's something that you stick your eye to. So, yeah, originally they did things like that, but then eventually they determined, as they developed detectors with it, and got a more calibrated camera to a spectrometer. So a spectrometer is more the scientific equipment. The spectroscope is the earlier idea with the eye. I would look at, and so they began to calibrate and get angles of it. At a particular point in time, they moved to working out the wavelength of light. Now, to work out the wavelength of light, there's various methods. I must admit, I actually don't know exactly how they worked out what the wavelength of light is to work out that this was so many centimeters of radiation. Ah, look, the only way that they could have worked out the wavelength of light cleanly is by using diffraction gratings. Once they used diffraction gratings, they had a known line spacing and used Bragg's law, I don't know, a diffraction law, which related the angle of light coming out to the wavelength. So a diffraction grating has a geometrical way of going. It's almost impossible to work out what a prism is, because you've got the dispersion of a prism. So that gave the actual wavelength. And then people decided that they'd look at various light sources, arc light sources, and so they're able to produce the atomic lamps, and produce the atomic lamps of various things. So you get molecular spectra and atomic spectra, and so you need a vacuum tube, and with vacuum tube you had vacuum discharges, and they looked able to look at the vacuum discharges of isolated gases, and these were all complicated except for hydrogen, and hydrogen displayed repeated sort of movement up to a alpha and beta, all the way up to infinity of lines, which used to get closer and closer together. So it looked as though you're looking at if you look at the lines, that look as though they go to a maximum, and of course that's the maximum is the ionization limit of it. So if you say for the Balmer series, which is visible n equals 2, as the light goes further and further and further, the actual electron leaves at the end and moves away, and so you've got the Lyman alpha series, which is a principal wavelength. It's in the ultraviolet, and that's I'm just trying to think, I've got an angstroms, so it's 124 nanometers. You've got limits like that. Helium has other limits, limits again, has a series of different lines there, and I think helium goes at around 80 nanometers as its ionization level. And it's interesting that the helium alpha, the equivalent of the Lyman alpha and the equivalent of the helium Lyman alpha line, which I've just got to remember, they're a unit of 4 past, if you actually put it into the Rydberg equations, which has Z in it, derived from Rutherford. Sorry, I'm just thinking aloud there. So you had a series of lines, and that helium, so hydrogen had a series of lines, and so they had the spectrometer meant that they could measure wavelength very well, the diffraction spectrometer, and the lines from the gas, so they'd have a gas discharge tube, which is evacuated with a small amount of hydrogen in it. I think the major way they produced atomic lines, rather than helium lines, was a hollowed cathode tube. So this is, the cathode was hollowed out, and it produced atomic lines rather than molecular lines. So if you got any amount of hydrogen in there, you'd be swamped by getting a molecular ion, so to produce it, they had a hollow cathode from it. This is just all going off memory, but together you had Rydberg, who said, I don't know what it means, but I can predict where lines are, and they go by a series, and we'll talk about that in a short while. And so Bohr came along and fitted it with it, and he So aping Einstein said, I'm going to call postulates. Like Einstein had, after a lot of thinking, thought that, well, this is the missing link which I had to connect all my theories together, whereas Bohr had one theory he wanted to get and just ramped out the postulates to hit it. So Bohr's postulates is that electrons go in circular non-radiating orbits. Electrons can transfer between one orbit and the next, a jump, that is, disappear from the universe, vaporize from the universe, and in no time, faster than the speed of light, incidentally. Okay, so you've got faster than light travel inside the Bohr atom, reappear at another energy level, and do so with no acceleration. So how's that for sort of mind-bendingness? And when it does so, it emits a photon of light that is predicted by Einstein energy by the photoelectric effect. So essentially it's an internal photoelectric effect. And then he said, all to fit, I postulate. I slam the table. And I think it's h bar on 2. I just have to really think the basic angular momentum change between levels. It's 1 unit of angular momentum. So that angular momentum change is the angular momentum of your photon. Your photon comes out with that unit. I think it will be h, the basic unit of angular momentum, for the spin there. And so he said that defines where the levels are. So he was able to use an angular momentum argument, h, and then churn it through to get the Rydberg number. And he actually, I think, got the Rydberg number numerically using h's and c's and e's, the electric charge, the coulombic charge. So there's the coulombic force in together. So he used that together. And he was a very dominant Dane. Let's tell you one story about Bohr. The British... Bohr raised money in Denmark for the Free Finland. The Russians were just grabbing anything, and historically Russia was always just nibbling away at the Swedish Empire. Sweden used to own Finland, and they actually pushed along, they pushed the Swedes away from what is now Leningrad. That's just over hundreds of years of gradual expansion, and they decided that they would take back Finland, because I don't know quite how it became there, but Commander Zhukov was off fighting the Japanese, and then he beat the Japanese because the Japanese decided they weren't going to fight the Russians, and so the Russians came up to invade Finland, and then Bohr was sort of, I don't know whether he had some Jewish heritage, but he was up in Denmark, the Germans came in, so there's all these things. I do remember that Bohr raised money for Save the Finnish People. The Finnish actually absolutely bloodied the Russian noses for a long time, but the Finnish were natural allies with the Germans because they were both fighting the Russians. However, there was issues there, and Bohr crossed up into Sweden, I think neutral Sweden. Sweden was aligned with the Germans as well, slightly. And the British flew a plane to get him out of the Axis's power. It became too hot, too difficult for him. And so they flew a Mosquito bomber, which is a fairly small plane. I've actually seen something similar to it. I think it couldn't be at Timora, maybe another plane. It's a small fighter bomber. It's, I actually knew my grade 6 teacher was a Mosquito fire pilot in World War II, so I know a little bit about it. So Mosquito is a twin-engine plane, but it's actually made of wood. Now, for some reason, someone said there's got a stick in the tail, it had some sort of rear armament, but I just can't really believe that was at all true. I don't know why people said that, and of course Mosquitoes don't have stings in their tail. However, they wrapped up Bohr in a blanket, and his head, Bohr, if you look at it, he's got a big head, and his head was too big for his helmet. So he basically went unconscious with lack of oxygen, and they flew at low altitude anyway, I think. And they had the instructions that if the Germans were going to capture him, capture Bohr, it was better just to kill him, so to open the bomb bays and fly off even at faster speed. So they flew back, and he they got him back after, in the middle of war. That's how he got to Britain. That's the story of Bohr, a side story. This is similar to how I would teach. I'd try not to actually give these stories there. Okay, now we've got to look at Davis and Germer. They were firing electrons at metals just to see how they bounced off, you know, what the recoil was, and the belief that the electrons could actually travel through metals. And I've just got to remember why they seriously believed it. They fired electrons through very thin foils, and they would emerge the other side of the foil, and therefore there was originally a belief that they were waves. But of course, this is the name's escaped me. This is where my brain's going. I know this. I always misspell the name. The person who Thompson, T-O-M, Thompson. Discovered the electrons and proved it was a particle, but there was a whole lot of belief that electrons were waves, because they could actually emerge from, actually travel through a very thin metal foils. So the only way to do is to get them through is waves. So electrons were believed at waves for a long, long time. The actual fact the Germans had a series of belief that electrons are waves, and to this day, some of the mad wave theory means that the description of the Maltese cross experiment, where you see the shadow of electrons, is still absolutely mad. They missed the actual interpretation of that. But let us get back. They had a nickel sample and an electron gun, which required a hot electrode, a extraction electric field, a local electric field which controlled the current, and then a series of optics. I think by this stage they were actually getting lenses, electrostatic lenses, to get a fairly fine monochromatic beam. So this is a major thing, is they've got a vacuum system and a monochromatic beam, Davis and Germer, and they're firing a beam of electrons of a particular energy. So the thing is, as they vary the energy, they can actually vary the wavelength, because if you look at the formula, it's M equals H on MV. You vary the energy, you vary the velocity, vary the wavelength. So it's important to say that that they got monochromatic electrons. So they're extracted. They've got a thermal distribution from the hot cathode, and that thermal contribution is added a little bit, so it's a fairly good acceleration, and then they're accelerated in a fairly good field from that acceleration, that extraction voltage. And they fired it at this nickel plate. Now, what they're very lucky in that they heated up the plate to vacuum bake it, to get rubbish off it, and this meant that the nickel softened and recrystallized, so they were able to get a single crystal face of nickel. So it's a single crystal of nickel. And they had a machine which collected a Coulomb cup, which collected the electrons at different angles. So as they moved at different angles, they're expecting specular reflection. So that is, if you come in at 45 degrees, it goes out at 45 degrees. But then they picked up some other secondary lumps of the crystals diffracting due to the Bragg law. Well, yeah, you've got the Bragg law for electrons, but also the Bragg law for crystals. So it was a periodic array of atoms were periodically scattering the electrons, and the electrons were emerging interfering with it, so reinforcing and reducing, and so the angle corresponded to the correct angle of the crystal and corresponded to the energy of the electron, corresponded to the mass of the electron, corresponded to the entire wavelength. And so this was put together. Now, de Broglie, he was a rich Frenchman, and he had a lot of money funding stuff. They had the Paris conference, a very famous Paris conference, and he was sort of from the noble class. He suggested that the particles, his explanation was that the particles had a wavelength, and the wavelength was related to the formula that they measured, and that he had that the electrons were doing some sort of constructive interference, so they could only exist at an orbital where the it all fitted together, that there was the S had one mode to it, so the N equals one, quantum number one, has one lump, so they were still going in a circle, but it was like a circular wave front. And this is really a footnote, like quantum mechanics completely blew this out of the water, but for some reason this got into schools, because you can sort of push the diagram of that Bohr has made, the famous target diagram, and actually put waves around the outside. So you could put one wavelength around the outside, then for a different wavelength, so the electrons are traveling more slowly around. This is something I have to work out how he had it, because I'll have to work it out, because the particles are traveling more slowly over a greater orbital distance. So he actually had physical orbital distances, and this worked along. I don't know whether I can be bothered going back, but it would seem to me that the electrons are going more slowly the further out they go, so they've got a bigger wavelength, which is doing my head in. But we don't have to really worry about it. No one's taking it seriously at this point in time. And we should also discuss back that Bohr had the Rydberg equation and the idea that the electrons were, and this is technically incorrect, the electrons are mostly empty space. This is a conclusion from Rutherford, that the nucleus was very small and positive. This is through the scattering equipment. So Rutherford, who I have to remember is a New Zealander up in Manchester University, Manchester, wanted to make a statement, and they had gave him heaps of money to go up there. And so he fired atoms, and most of the atoms went straight through. So basically, if you had a herd of elephants charging at you and you had a gun, you wouldn't have to aim it too much. But if you had hummingbirds coated with poison dart toxin flying at you, you'd have to get your gun and fire an awful lot of bullets, or fire one very accurately. And so, essentially, they didn't know what they were coming at with them. Were they having it? Was it the nucleus, an elephant-sized thing, or a hummingbird with poison dart neurotoxin on the end of it? And it was the latter. It was very small. Now we go into, before we go in, the group of equations that we would use in this area. One is force equals Q. V, the velocity of the electron or charged particle. B, the field in Tesla, sine theta, the angle to that field. So if you have to be perpendicular to the field for sine, so sine at 90 degrees to the field is 1. The electric field is the voltage over the distance. This is another equation that we have, and that's a definition of electric field, I suppose. The voltage in so many volts per meter over a distance. Energy is H times the frequency. H is Planck's constant, energy in joules. Planck's constant they give you is in joules, joules seconds, and F is to the minus 1. C, the speed of light equals frequency of the light times the lambda of the light. Then the Rydberg equation is given to you, 1 on lambda. The lambda is the wavelength that you measure in meters, equals, well, it wasn't, Rydberg constant wasn't in meters to start off with. It could have been. Big R is the Rydberg constants, which you would find out there, and then 1 on N squared F minus 1 on N squared I. Now, as N squared F got very big, the difference between successive distance, so the difference between half, say for instance, a quarter and a ninth is much bigger than the distance between, say, 12 squared and 11 squared, one on 121 and one on 144. The actual comparative difference there is less. The actual, so you actually go out to, as n f really goes large, it actually each successive distance is a lot less. It's one on n squared. And then our famous one, which we're going to use this time, is that lambda equals h on mv. V is the velocity of what's going on. Now let's look at this question. And my goodness, it's a 4-mark question. So how are they going to get 4 marks out of this? Question C. Explain why the spectroscope was important in the development of the Bohr model of the atom. So, unfortunately, this is a short answer. It's a really direct answer anyway. Short question, direct answer, but let's work back. The Bohr model of the atom was based on a combination of fusing Rutherford's discovery of the small nucleus together with the discovery of Thomson of the electronic mass, relative mass, with the unknown Rydberg relationship, which you would write the formula that I've just quoted there, and it's stated as a, for 4 marks, and it's stated, and we're going to use this later on, it's stated if it says explain, you have to use the word because or explanation under. They have to give you a mark if you say because. Okay, getting back. And so this formula is important for the development, the Bohr model. And in brackets for model, you'd say very simply either draw the diagram or do fixed circular non-radiative orbit. Photon out with a jump and set angular momentum spaces. So this is the one important clue. Now the spectroscope was an initial development, a visual development, and it was the forerunner of spectrometers, which had diffraction gratings, which gave precise wavelengths, which allowed the identification of the actual hydrogen lines for which the Bohr model works. So that's why the spectrometer is important, because it was the forerunner of the diffraction grating spectrometer or spectrometer, you call it spectrometer, or yeah, that's what you call it, which gave the wavelengths, which was fitted, which had a regular pattern, which was fitted by Rutherford, by Rydberg. Now, okay, we're now here. This is the official answer. So it's 4 marks. Explains the importance of the spectroscope in the development of the model. The Rutherford model of the atom consisted of a positive nucleus and surrounding electrons. I should have said positive. Okay. However, it was not known how the electrons were arranged, or how they were prevented from radiating the energy. Okay, the spectroscope allowed scientists to identify characteristic spectroscopic lines of different elements, including hydrogen. These lines caused Bohr to hypothesize the existence of a stable fixed orbit, since it suggested that there were fixed gaps between the available energy levels? We had to also add with Einstein said that the transition between energy levels was lined, so something I macked up there. Without the spectroscope, Bohr could have made this hypothesis and would have developed this atom of the molecule. So I could possibly definitely improve my answer by actually saying the fact that they are lines indicated that they were going through stable states. That's something I missed out on. The spectroscope, the actual spacing, and the fact that there were lines fitted to go. Okay. Part D. In 1927, Davidson and Germer reported the results of an experiment in which they fired electrons at a crystal of nickel and observed how the electrons were scattered. State their conclusion with reference to the result they obtained. They concluded that the electrons had wave-like properties consistent with the formula given, lambda equals blah blah blah, with reference because they found intensity equaling an angle which was explained by the nickel spacing and the mass of electrons and that particular equation. So that's, and you draw a very brief diagram showing electrons firing into a nickel crystal and a range of angles, rather than specular angle, a diffracted angle. That would be my two. Now, number three, explain the significance of the experiment to the Rutherford-Bohr model of the atom. Rutherford had hypothesized that the electrons were fixed at orbits given a integer, quantized level of angular momentum added between each. But he just says that the postulates, this gave a reason for why you would have stable states, which is that it was an electron standing wave in each state going up. Okay, look, that's I'll see how they go. Okay, their answer was I left one out. The first answer is Davidson and Germer found that electrons formed interference pattern after the passage through the crystal. Since the interference phenomenon was only observed with waves, they concluded that electrons were also waves. Okay. Passage through the crystal. I think it was... I really do think it's a specular reflection. I'll have to actually look that up. In fact, you will have to look it up. My understanding was that it's actually reflection off the surface. Well, I'll be amazed if it is. I'll have to check that out. And... for part two, for 3 marks, the Rutherford-Bohr consisted of the fixed electrons, but was unable to explain why these orbits were stable. The knowledge of the electrons were waves enables an explanation, as indicated by de Broglie, where the electrons can only exist in the orbits where it experiences constructive interference. Or a standing wave, so I think I would have got that. So I'm going to go away quickly. I might do a quick ad to see whether it's actually through Davidson-Germer did through or did a reflection off it. My understanding is that for the energy of the electrons to actually go through, that'd have to be pretty high energy electrons to get that separation through. And you wouldn't have had the annealing properties of it. Thanks for listening. In the meantime, keep on, as I'm doing, doing science by actually going through the answers, thinking science, thinking the answers, and eventually when you do understand things, teaching science. Thanks for listening. Hello again. I've just gone to the internet and actually looked at the pictures, and yeah, they're 100% a reflection. It's not transmission. It's not through, and the actual cup is the actual fact that they use is basically a Coulomb cup, which actually measured the actual current going in. There's no multiplication. There was some sort of table for it. Look, thanks a lot for listening. I'll get back to you soon. I just thought I would say that rather than leave you hanging. It's definitely a reflection rather than a transmission, as stated across there. And what's really interesting is that if you say that to teachers, look, I think I found a mistake. Their general assumption is that you're losing your cognitive ability, but that mustn't be the case. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening.